Welcome back. We are on page 35. The top says Rahab and spies, and the bottom says Jericho's fall. This page essentially covers Joshua 1 through 6. So let's jump in. The story of Rahab starts in Joshua 2. The spies are sent into Jericho. Now, remember, spies were sent into Jericho. I believe it was Jericho. If not Jericho, then another town on the edge of the Promised Land 40 years ago. And out of the spies sent in there, only two spies, Caleb and Joshua, came out believing in God. So this is kind of like a redemptive thing, a redo moment where spies are going to again go into this town and scout it out and see what it looks like so that they can come up with a plan of attack. They don't know this, but God's going to actually give them a very strategic plan of attack that has nothing to do with how they scout it out. But here, Joshua kind of repeats Moses' behavior, sends them in, and they went. And it just introduces this new character we've never met before named Rahab, right here, Joshua 2. Let me read it for you. Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. Okay, into the house of a what? A harlot? So Rahab is a prostitute. As a matter of fact, we believe, I don't really know where we get this, but biblical scholars confirm she was not just a prostitute. She ran a house of prostitutes. She is a small businesswoman, prostitute style. Okay, so she is not probably somebody that the Israelite men should be associating themselves with. But here she is, the unexpected one who actually saves them from being caught. She hides them in her house, and then she promises them that she will continue to keep them safe and give them safe passage in and out of Jericho if she can be assured that she will be safe when Jericho falls. This is pretty remarkable because Rahab is showing how much she knows about God and the Israelite people as a Jericho, citizen. So she and all the other people of Jericho, supposedly, they are not blind to the fact that Israel is encamped in the desert, just like waiting to attack them. So when Rahab meets them, she's like, "I know who you are and I know whose God you are. And I'm going to make a covenant with you, a deal with you, so that I am safe." Let's read Joshua 2, starting at 8. "Before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away from you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you, when you came out of the land of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, to Shiloh and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no courage left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God is he who is God, in heaven and above earth and on earth beneath. Now then, swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you will also deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign, and save alive my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death.' And the men agreed." So Rahab is smart. She knows who they are. She saves them, and then she kind of secures her own freedom. And as they promise, when Jericho falls, Rahab's tower stays up. So that's kind of a crazy thing. Not only that, Rahab marries this guy named Salmon, okay? Salmon is in the bloodline. So Rahab, this prostitute from Jericho, is the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus. She's in the bloodline. This is crazy. And I just think biblical scholars agree, it goes to show God is so comfortable with messy families. He knows that we can have messy families and messy descendants and ancestors, and that's okay. There's a huge, forgiveness piece here, that Rahab is forgivable, even despite her pretty icky kind of sin. Now, Rahab uses this rope to let them up and down the window. It's kind of like a Rapunzel, let down your hair. She lets down the rope. They climb up the tower. They sneak around the city. They go back out. And the rope is scarlet, red, crimson. And it kind of reminds us of Isaiah, where Isaiah 1:18 says, "Though your sins be like scarlet, God will make them as white as snow." That's exactly what happened with Rahab. She was a red woman, in a sense, and she was forgiven and washed clean as snow and brought into the fold and made into the bride, right? When Jericho falls, her tower stays up. We talked about that. That's how they get themselves into the Promised Land in the first place. Moving down to Jericho's fall, now they kind of know what they're going to do. They start advancing toward Jericho. And on the way here, Joshua actually has a dream and a vision and a message from God about how God wants him to attack. But at this point, as they're marching toward Jericho, they don't really know what they're going to do. They're probably, oh my gosh, we're a little nervous, you know, that they're about to take their first city. And a couple of things happen. We'll call them three things. First, Israel passes over the Jordan. And by passes over the Jordan, I mean passes through the Jordan, just like the Red Sea parted for them. The Jordan River also parts for them. This is in Joshua 3:15. And when those who bore the ark, the Levite priests, remember those are the only ones who are allowed to touch the ark, had come to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, the Jordan overflows all of its banks throughout the time of the harvest. The waters came down from above and stood and rose in a heap far off at Adam, the city that is beside Zarethan. And those flowing down toward the Sea of Araba, the Salt Sea, were wholly cut off, and the people passed opposite Jericho. And while all Israel were passing over on dry ground, the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood on the dry ground in the midst of the Jordan until the nation finished passing over the Jordan. So the Ark of the Covenant and the Levites bearing it is the thing that parts the sea. Instead of Moses' staff, that was the original thing that parted the sea. Now, quick note here, do you hear all the details that are involved here? Joshua is clearly a historic narrative book. They are telling facts about the land. They're telling places. It's like they're trying to identify where things are happening on purpose so that you know this was a real story. So they pass over the Jordan, all 600,000 of them, okay? It's a big event. And then before they go on, Joshua does this thing. We're going to call this thing number two that happens before Jericho's fall. First thing, they cross the Jordan. Second thing, they set up these memory stones. Okay, this is Joshua 4, starting at verse 1. When all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, and each tribe a man, and command them, take 12 stones from here, out of the midst of the Jordan, and from the very place where the priest's feet stood, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. Then Joshua called the 12 men from the sons of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe, and Joshua said to them, pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel, that this may be a sign among you when your children ask in the time to come, what do those stones mean to you? Then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the sons of Israel a memorial forever. So they essentially erect this big old stack of stones, okay? Why is, you know, God is all about remembering. Remember Deuteronomy. The main theme of Deuteronomy is remember, remember, remember what the Lord has done. And the Lord knows, and we're going to find out soon, that the people are very much going to forget. The last time that God opened a body of water, the Red Sea, a couple chapters later, the people had forgotten and they made a golden cow and they worshiped it and they thanked the golden cow for getting them out of Egypt. So now, as he gets them across this second body of water, he's like, hold it, let's have a little marking spot so that if anybody forgets, you can look back at those stones and say, remember when we built that? Remember that God got us across that? So he's trying to prevent sin before it happens, give them good, remembering devices. Okay, and then the third thing that happens, they pass the Jordan, they build their memory stone tower, and then chapter 5 of Joshua, the sons of Israel are circumcised. Now, this is an interesting one. They're circumcised here? They're circumcised here in the outskirts of Jericho? Why weren't they circumcised when they were born? Because the covenant of Abraham specifies that all men need to be circumcised. So they've been circumcising since then for years and years and years at birth to prevent, you know, pain of an adult man having to go through this. So why did Moses' leadership not enforce this? Do you remember in Exodus, right after the burning bush, right at Exodus 4, Moses was a covenant breaker. His son Gershom was not circumcised, and Zipporah circumcised Gershom and touched the foreskin to Moses' feet and saved the day. So Moses, I mean, we can't blame him for not liking circumcision, but like he is not doing it. He's not doing his covenant duty. An entire generation of Israelites have grown up in the desert under his charge and not been circumcised, right? This is weird. So Joshua does the thing. Joshua's like, we're going to fix this. We're not going to go into battle here with the Lord on behalf of the Lord in the Lord's name with the Ark of the Covenant uncovenantally. We're going to do the right thing. We're going to dot our I's and cross our T's. So this is what he does. Joshua 5:5, though all the people who came out of the land had been circumcised, all the people that were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. So they get circumcised, and then they rest for a little bit, and they have Passover, their remembering meal. And then we've got Joshua's vision here at the tail end of chapter 5. He has a vision of exactly what he's supposed to do, and he does it. So the attack on Jericho is not probably as anybody thought it was going to be. It's not really a military attack. It's really a liturgical procession. It's a prayer attack. It's a spiritual attack. It's, again, kind of an exorcism of the pagan city Jericho. Jericho worships pagan gods, including the moon god, including Baal. And they march around the city and they yell and it falls down. So it's a procession. There's trumpets. There's the Levites carrying the Ark of the Covenant, but nobody actually fights anybody. And still Jericho falls. Let's look at a couple details here. In chapter 6 is really the story. Days 1 through 6, they march around the city once with the Ark and with the trumpets and with the people. And then on the seventh day, they march 7 times around the city. And when they're all done, they yell as loud as they can. So again, remember 7? 7 says oath, and 7 reminds us of creation. And now they're uncreating Jericho in 7 days. So there's kind of some visual stuff there. When they yell and scream, it falls, except for Rahab's tower. And then they kind of go into the rubble, and they've conquered it, right? So God tells them through Joshua one big instruction, big important thing. In Joshua 6:18, you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction. What he's saying is there's gold and silver here, precious jewels, but they have been devoted to pagan gods. They are tainted. They're bad. Don't touch them. And as the people go in to pillage and plunder and take whatever food, whatever they need, they're supposed to avoid taking this stuff. But one guy disobeys. His name is Achan. And he is a troublemaker because of him, the next battle they do, they lose. And his whole family dies. He gets a big punishment. 7:1, Joshua 7:1. The sons of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah of the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things. And the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. So literally God just delivered Jericho to them. And he can't even obey God's command. That don't be idolatrous, bride. You're the bride. Stick with your bridegroom who just delivered Jericho into your hands. But instead, Achan's like, I'm going to take some of that pagan gold. That looks awesome. So in chapter 8, they go forward to take this tiny little town of Ai. I don't know how you're supposed to say it. It literally is spelled Ai. And they lose. They should have destroyed these people, but they lose. And this is a punishment for Achan. In chapter 8 as well, they reread the law of Mount Ebal, and they renew the covenant in Joshua 8, starting at 30 to 35. So because of the sin, they've got to do it. I forgot to say, but this kind of reminds me of like Aladdin and the Cave of Wonders, how he's not supposed to touch anything, touch nothing but the lamp. And then Abu steals a gem, and then the whole thing comes tumbling down. This is this moment in the Bible. This is it. But they renew the covenant, and then they go on pillaging and plundering and repeat all the way through Joshua until the end, where Joshua exhorts them in Joshua 24:15, decide today whom you will serve. And they kind of settle into their land. Okay, that is that story.